Interestingly, it's something that I've been thinking about for probably 5 to 10 years. I became chair of our program in 2013, and we just hadn't done it for no other reason than the inertia to take it on. You know, it's sometimes a bureaucratic red tape kind of journey, but it was a perfect time. I said, well, since I'm on this committee, I can document it. I can provide data. I can create my journey, if you will, so that maybe other programs can follow suit. And so that's what I did.
Welcome to the People of Pathology podcast. I'm Dennis Strank. On this podcast, we explore pathology, laboratory medicine, forensic science, and how to embrace technology in these fields. If you're familiar with laboratory advocacy, you've probably heard of today's guest, Dr. Rodney Rohde. Advocating for the medical laboratory field includes things like increasing visibility and awareness of the field. A good way to do that is with a standardized title and credentials. Now let's hear how Dr. Rohde led an effort to accomplish this at his own program. So it's been quite a while since I had you on the podcast. I think it was July of 2022. So I'm happy we could have you back, get a little update on what, because you're always very busy. So let's get an update on what you've been up to. So I appreciate you being here, Dr. Rohde, once again.
Yeah, thank you. It's always an honor to join you on People of Pathology. I'm looking forward to talking about, you know, one of the areas that I'm really passionate about, as you are, which is raising visibility of medical laboratory careers, recruitment, and retention, and all the things kind of surrounding that workforce issue right now across the country.
Yeah. You were telling me you got involved with something called the ASCP's Blueprint for Action. And I'm curious about this, if we can go back to the beginning of that project. How did you get involved?
Yeah, right. So yeah, absolutely want to give some acknowledgments here to the American Society for Clinical Pathology and their entire amazing staff and team that put together something called the Blueprint for Workforce Strategy. And so that Blueprint for Action is really something that came along. This was probably a little bit before the fall of 2022 for a time frame. And it really came about. They also worked with a group called the Clinton Global Initiative, which really convenes global leaders to create, implement solutions to, you know, a lot of the challenges, including healthcare. At ASCP and many other societies, this is a pretty big coalition trying to make things better with respect to workforce shortages. We all know that this was not just a COVID problem. COVID just exacerbated it and amplified it with respect to shortages and other things going on.
Yeah.
This has been going on since that time frame, and I've been a part of it.
You said that the Clinton Foundation, is that like the Bill and Hillary Clinton?
My understanding, it is the CGI.
Okay.
And I was, you know, there's so many people, Dennis, you know, just amazing people that are working on these types of solutions. And so I'm just one of many. I'm just one of many on this team. Our actual workforce committee has multiple aims and recommendations. It's being led by Dr. Susan Harrington, and then multiple ASCP staff members. And then I just was invited to join the gang. And so this happened back in 2022, and I've been part of it ever since, including, which we'll talk about later, I'm sure, I'm kind of leading up a subcommittee within that group to work on name change, kind of name consolidation around medical laboratory science.
Okay, I like it. This sounds like a very worthwhile project for sure. And you're right. I mean, the problem, yes, it was exacerbated by COVID, but, you know, we know that it's been there for a long time.
Yeah, it really has. And I don't know, you know, we don't need to go through the entire workforce plan, but there were three big aims. Maybe you would like me to mention them.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. And again, you can find all of this online through just a quick Google search and or ASCP. The first aim is really about increasing the visibility of clinical laboratory occupations. And there's four recommendations under that. I'm just going to briefly mention recommendation four because it's one I'm pretty much involved with, and that's promoting the consistent use of occupational titles and roles. And so that's kind of my subcommittee within this first aim. Aim two, which is logical, we're trying to expand and improve workforce retention and recruitment of all laboratory professionals. And then AIM 3 is really continually trying to increase the entire diversity and inclusion of the workforce across academic recruiting and employer efforts and things like that. And then there's some priorities and opportunities. And so, you know, the priorities really were to develop a nationwide coalition. So that's, we think, been done pretty well. We wanted to form a workforce steering committee, which we've done. And we're, you know, moving forward with securing funding to implement all of these blueprint recommendations, as well as, you know, bring new coalitions in, bring new people in, really do whatever it takes to kind of make these aims come to fruition. We know it won't be a shortcut. It's going to take some time, but we need it to be sustainable and ongoing because of, you know, the life-saving efforts of these professionals.
Sure. Okay. You mentioned a subcommittee already. You told me about another one. You said it was a subcommittee that aims to improve visibility and awareness. Tell me about that. What's happening with that subcommittee?
Yeah, so that committee is really trying to, I mean, these are, you know, all really logical things that many of us have worked on for years, but we're trying to be more purposeful about it. So that group is working on encouraging interest in the field and the career education of a medical laboratory professional and training by going all the way down to elementary and middle school students and really, you know, kind of exposing them to the laboratory field. Again, these are things, you know, many of these professional organizations and even individuals, including academic programs like myself, do. We do this quite often, but trying to be more purposeful and more national, including out into rural areas and things like that. We're also looking at promoting the visibility and awareness of the different medical laboratory occupations in high school, you know, on college campuses and professional groups. One of the things that I've been really pushing hard personally within my own leadership of my medical lab science program at Texas State University is really using medical laboratory science as the major, because so many college students don't really say, where can I find the medical lab science major? You know, they're typically using words like pre-med or STEM or biology or nursing or any of the other health science kind of forward-facing, patient-facing types of professions. And so as we know, we need to get that name recognition, I believe, just so people start using that all the way down into high schools and early college, including early college, Dennis, because we know, I mean, I've seen it for 22 years, and it's really my story. You know, we have a lot of people that come in and become biology majors, pre-med majors, chemistry majors. I was a microbiology major. I had no idea. And many, many students I talk to that are, you know, between 17 years of age and all the way up to, you know, getting ready to graduate, don't know about our major unless they pick up a book or search through a catalog or search online and they just kind of accidentally come across it.
Yep.
Or one of our majors. This is our greatest ambassadors. There's really a lot of my own students. So we have 20 students every year that come in our program. And I actually instruct them and train them and beg them and encourage them when they're taking other prerequisites, because they're still taking a few prerequisites in their first year, their junior year. I'm like, hey, spread the word. You know, talk about this major to students that are taking microbiology with you or anatomy and physiology or an organic chemistry class. Tell them what you're doing, but get them excited about testing. Ask them, do they want to work in a hospital laboratory? Because without this degree and credential, you can't go do that. And that's my story. I had to kind of learn it later after two degrees. And interestingly, I'm leading the program I never heard about at my alma mater. I mean, I had two degrees, 7 years of education, graduated with a master's in virology and a bachelor's in microbiology, started applying for jobs and no one would hire me because I didn't have this thing called a MLS credential. And so I learned really quickly, to my parents' dismay, that, you know, I was going to have to look for other employment opportunities. And fortunately, public health really worked out for me. I wouldn't really change it, but it was a longer arc to get back to working in medical laboratory areas. So it's just it's a story that I can tell. And I can let people know that I was in your boat, and it's okay. You can still get here. You just might have to either switch majors, or you might have to finish your biology major and come back for two more years for a second a second degree, which, you know, it takes time and money. So we really don't want people to have to do that. So it's awareness, a lot of awareness and visibility issues.
Yeah, that is, I know we've talked about this before. That's similar to my story as well. I majored in biology, graduated from college, and it's like, all right, what do I do with this?
Right.
And how you said that changing the major to medical laboratory science, I was talking about this with someone not too long ago. It might've been actually my sister, because she's got a son who's 14 and is interested in science. This biology degree that I got, I feel like that major really, in most cases, shouldn't exist anymore. It should be medical laboratory science. And the same
It's interesting. I always tell people, I don't know if it's totally shouldn't exist, but I think people need to understand that the advising level and even chairs and professors, and don't get me wrong, there is nothing wrong with core science degrees. I mean, they do some interesting things, but they need to know their pathway.
Yeah.
It's probably going to be multiple degrees. They're probably going to end up needing a PhD to get the types of jobs or research jobs that they want. They're not working in healthcare, period. Unless they go through med school, or they go to nursing school, or they go to medical lab science or respiratory care. There's so many professions that it's almost a tragedy that high school students don't know that they could be a nuclear medicine technician. They could be a sonographer. There are just crazy numbers of healthcare careers that are good paying jobs. You can go all over the country and you're employed when you walk out the door with that college degree. So
yep.
Just knowing what they are and knowing what you're getting into. Because we do need hardcore biochemists.
Sure.
But we also need medical lab scientists.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing, I guess for me, it was like you just said, you get out of college and you have a job. When you're a medical laboratory scientist, you have a job. Whereas
there's no greater recruiting statement for me when I'm talking, usually not just to the student that's visiting us, but to their parents or their friends. And I'm like, look, let me tell you my story in a quick way. And so I usually go through my story and say, when you go through this program or really any of the allied health or health science, because I do work at the level where I'm often promoting other programs like respiratory care or whatever. I'm like, just any one of those will allow your child or loved one usually to have a job before they graduate, because they're doing clinicals, they're getting to know people, there's desperate shortages.
Yep.
I mean, it's a no-brainer if you want to do that career. They just need to know.
Okay, this sort of relates to my next question, because you recently co-authored an article with Angela Tomei Robinson, who's also been on the podcast, and it was called Workforce in the Shadow of Healthcare, an Update on the Survival Status of Laboratory Medicine and Public Health. And I want to just briefly get into this article, because it kind of touches on some of the topics we've already been talking about. So what can you say about the status of the profession?
Yeah. First, let me give a shout out to Angela. You mentioned Angela Tomei Robinson. She is a wonderful friend and kind of partner in crime with
she's
working
great
with me. And she is wonderful. She is so passionate. And we decided we'd been wanting to write something. We've written some other things together, but we just really wanted to do something like this. So we found a way to get that done. And really the article is kind of, again, a logical look at our field. And even the title, Workforce in the Shadows of Healthcare, that's obviously talking about what we were just discussing, a visibility, and really looking at what's going on. And so I would say right now, we are still in desperate shortages across the country. I also, by the way, have many colleagues up in Canada and other places across the world. And this is not defined just by the United States. There are issues in Canada and other places around the world that are really suffering.
Yeah.
From COVID burnout and ongoing issues. But I think right now, most of what the data says, and the paper goes into this, it goes into all the surveys and all the statistics, but we're really seeing right up through 2023 in a definitive healthcare report that since 2020, about 1 in 5 healthcare workers have quit their jobs. And research is suggesting that up to 47% of healthcare workers plan to leave their professions by 2025. That is terrifying.
Yeah, it is.
It's just terrifying, right? And it's not just medical lab science. That's looking at the big picture of all of healthcare, but regardless, we're part of that. And of course, we know, we've already mentioned it, the pandemic helped in some ways because it did bring the future of work into the present. Like, we have to solve these problems, but it also exacerbated burnout and, you know, stress and workload. And again, sometimes lack of recognition and respect and lack of compensation, unfortunately, for medical ed scientists. And then with the ongoing, you know, the catch words of the Great Resignation and things like that, we have all this going on together. So that's kind of the statistics and kind of rough data surrounding our current status. We have gained awareness and visibility. So that's the good part of what's happened after COVID and during COVID. I think now, you know, one of my catchphrases, and it's in the paper, why should anyone care? And I talk about how we form the backbone of healthcare, right? And public health, both. I think they're one and the same. I've been on both sides. I was a 10-year public health microbiologist and molecular epidemiologist, and it's a wonderful path. We need both, shortages in both. And we together, we conduct about 14 billion with a B laboratory tests annually in the United States. And now you throw on probably, you know, we report about 1.2 billion COVID tests, but Lord knows it's probably way more than that with all of the data collecting and craziness that was going on during that time. So I just think that if the pandemic has taught us nothing else, if we don't find out a way to create and deliver diagnostic laboratory testing and understand it's the foundation of all patient safety and quality, then we're really failing the public and patient quality and things like that. So that's kind of the data and statistics, right? Would you like to chat about some of our commentary around solutions? And
I would, actually, because I was just going to mention that because, you get into the statistics and kind of the, sort of the bad news part, but you don't leave it there. You've got, I think it was like 16 different possible solutions for this.
Right.
Which I think is great. So yeah, let's get into some of those.
Yeah. So first of all, we believe that the band-aids that have been offered for many years, you know, kind of quick shortcuts, just has to stop. You know, the band-aids that are sometimes being offered are things like, let's do this with on-the-job training and reduced entry-level personnel standards. We think that's never the answer. I mean, would you want that for any other healthcare professional that's taking care of your parents or something like that? You absolutely want the strongest academically, clinically prepared medical laboratory scientist that you can find. And so we think that's important to keep front and center. We need long-term solutions to maintain that. We always throw this around: quality, patient quality, reducing medical errors. You know, 70%+ of all healthcare data that physicians used comes out of a medical laboratory and other types of laboratories.
Right.
So, I mean, right there should be a no-brainer that you want to really eliminate or reduce any issues around workforce problems or workload strain, because you do not want people making errors. Once you make an error with data, it follows that patient all the way through. I mean, it can absolutely be life-threatening. So how do we do that, right? So we've kind of broken this into four really key areas. Professions really need strategic assistance from media attention. That's one. Public awareness, two. Three would be industry respect. And lastly, and certainly not least, is legislative support. And so I'm also throwing in here, it's in the paper, this is not just medical laboratory professions, this is also public health. We absolutely need to be thinking about both. Mm-hmm. And we need each and every one of us really kind of within and even outside of our profession to play a role and contribute. And so Angela kind of coined this phrase, attract, recruit, and retain is kind of our call to arms, if you will. But so we do have about 16 comments under that. I don't know if you want me to go through them. They're pretty extensive, but we could kind of pop around a little bit maybe.
Let's try and hit a couple of the major ones.
Okay. So one we've already kind of talked about, and that is we absolutely think we have to expand our outreach, whatever that means. Healthcare, career fairs, visiting high schools. One of the things we're doing in our subcommittee and in our bigger committee with ASCP is to even look at big national conferences that bring in all of the advising staff for high schools counselors and advisors, as well as college types of conferences like that. So we start getting in, not just enlightening the educators, but advisors, counselors, and all those people that can help amplify and be synergistic for those things. And this could be, if you've never heard of them, even thinking not just of STEM, but there's other pushes for HOSA and AHEC and STEP. These are different kind of acronyms that really encourage health science or health careers at the middle school, high school level. So that's one thing that our committee is really working on.
Okay. I like that a lot.
Yeah. I mean, that's got to be sustained, right? That's sometimes it's one school at a time. One that I'm working with, and we can come back to this if you want to, is standardizing as much as we can to one identity. We want to get that medical laboratory scientist name supported by professional societies. Many of them have adopted that, including ASCP, ASCLS, AMT. I'm working with COLA, which is kind of a regulatory body in the laboratory accreditation community, and they're looking at a big umbrella term of laboratory scientists, but understanding medical lab scientists fall in that. I think that's one way to kind of think about it as well. And so I'll talk a little bit more about that in detail later, maybe when we talk about my efforts at Texas State with my own program.
Yeah.
We want to get into compensation. The career path has often been rough for some people because even as pre-pandemic, 5-6 years ago, some of my graduates, and by the way, this degree is tough. It is a rigorous 4-year hardcore science degree. You really have to major in 4 areas: clinical micro, clinical chemistry, immunohematology, which is blood banking, and then hematology. And then on top of all that, you got massive efforts for quality control and quality assurance and safety, and just goes on and on. So it's really critical and really difficult and rigorous, including clinicals. And so they deserve a fair salary and benefits equal to nursing and respiratory care therapists and others, because those are bachelor's degrees as well. And we think we are right there with them in importance, and we're not taking anything away from them. We just want to rise to those levels. So that takes, a lot of education for employers. It takes a lot of education for legislative staff, perhaps, if you're getting into that area. And so there's groups of people working on that. We are working really hard to start thinking about and utilizing those on the kind of the front end of our career, including phlebotomists and laboratory assistants, to really help us with pre and post analytical phases to help maybe reduce some of the workload strain for the MLS or even MLT, so that we bring in more help in some of those areas on the front end or back end that can be really helpful with workload issues. Probably one of the really big ones here is we really want to, this is going to be a tough one, Dennis, but
okay.
A lot of us want to move forward with some type of way to passage the right to practice profession licensure in all states, so that we have almost a national licensure in all states, like physicians and nurses and pharmacists have, and even PAs. It's going to be tough because that gets into legislative processes. Lord knows we've been trying it in Texas for 15, 20 years, if not longer. My predecessor, his name's David Fleur, and he was the chair of my program, and now he's retired. He used to tell me on my tombstone, it will say licensure. I tried. He has just been working on it for forever.
Okay.
And so many people do, but it's just difficult, as anything in the legislative process, depending on your state makeup and what they think about regulatory issues and all those things get really difficult, but we're trying to get that going, to move beyond just the kind of basic ground level CLIA types of limitations and things that we look at, to really, again, mm-hmm. advance, patient quality. It all comes back to patient quality. Continue to work with, other legislative actions and we rose up and did a pretty good job recently with Congress to kind of make sure that we kept our scope of practice, that it didn't bleed over into nurses.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah, right. I mean, and again, my daughter-in-law's a nurse, just entered my family. I love her to death. I love nurses. They're amazing. but they're not trained or educated to do moderate and complex laboratory testing. It would be dangerous for anyone to get into that world if they didn't know what they were doing. And we all know automation is sometimes talked about as an answer. Even that is dangerous because there's so much quality control and how to handle, you know, running standards. And is the machine telling you the right thing? You have to have the right critical eye and even a suspicious behavior of a medical lab scientist to make sure it's doing the right thing.
Okay.
There's lots more here. You know, maybe we can direct people to check out our paper, and lot of it's pretty logical stuff, you know, with respect to supporting professional organizations and workforce study surveys and data ongoing and on and on and on, including expanding medical lab programs at the educational level. We need more across the country. So all of those things are going to be really critical.
Yeah, I'll include a link to the paper in the show notes for sure.
This is the People of Pathology podcast with our guest, Dr. Rodney Rohde. We'll be right back.
LabVine is an interactive online learning platform where laboratory professionals learn, develop, and discover by sharing knowledge and building on each other's experience. The platform provides global access to internationally accredited laboratory-specific courses and other resources developed by lab specialists, like us, for the laboratory industry. LabVine is free to sign up, and you can use the link in the show notes to get started. If you're trying to understand the ever-changing world of digital pathology and image analysis, there's a new course that can help you, Pathology 101 for Tissue Image Analysis. Now, this course was created by Dr. Alexandra Zhuroff, who you might remember from episode 53 of this podcast. She also writes the Digital Pathology Place blog and hosts the Digital Pathology podcast. Pathology 101 for Tissue Image Analysis aims to bridge the gap between computer science and pathology and explains some of the complicated concepts in image analysis. You can sign up for this course by following the link in the show notes.
Now for the rest of my conversation with Dr. Rodney Rohde on the People of Pathology podcast.
All right, so then you mentioned the standardization of the title and how you're doing that in your own program. So let's go to that then. Why is it important to standardize this title? Well, let's go back even before that. So I know kind of the two main ones are MLS and CLS. And I've always wondered, why are there two to begin with?
Yeah, so that gets into some of the history even before I got super involved in this, but CLS, clinical laboratory scientist, came out of, not only is one of our professional organizations named the American Society for Clinical Laboratory Science, it used to be medical technology. So they kind of transitioned from medical technology to clinical lab scientist.
Yeah.
But that's one part of it. And then we even had, ASCLS even had a board test called the CLS. It was a credential. Again, my former chair had both MLS and CLS credentials. He took both tests. And many people did that. But again, as you can imagine, Dennis, just from a nomenclature standpoint, there's enough acronyms out there already to be problematic. So we just felt, and this came probably 10 or 15 years ago now, there was a group of people, we got together, and I'm not an expert on this, but they came in, they basically dissolved the CLS and merged with ASCP's Board of Certification and took on medical laboratory scientist. We just thought that was the best name for the credential. And that's when really the effort started moving forward for program name changes. It's really sometimes one of the big things with this that some other people are working on is getting human resources and employers to understand, because we still haven't sometimes reached into the hospital.
Oh yeah.
Matrix and quagmire of red tape to get just titles, right? I mean, so somebody will have an MLS credential, but they might be named still medical technologist one.
Right.
Or medical technologist two, or, you know, health scientist, or just laboratory, just all sorts of different names out there. So we're really working on that as well. That's kind of outside my scope. But again, it's kind of a big process. But that's where it kind of came from, was just the idea to get it as close as we could across as many organizations as possible. We know we're not going to reach every single person. We'd like to, but we want to have as big a percentage of the pie as we can to help consolidate the degree, the program names, the job titles, as well as the credential into medical laboratory scientist. So that, and then as I mentioned, the all important major, the name of the major, that's something I don't want to leave out here, so that we continually push that name on purpose with our faculty, colleagues, alumni, and leadership, so that it becomes second nature, so that people quit saying med tech or bench tech or tech. That, you know, that really, that really, I think in some ways underplays our education and our rigorous background. I want people to know how difficult this degree is and how smart and how critical our professionals are that are doing this work every day for them.
Okay. I like it. That's a good message. Although it, like you've been saying, that does sound really complicated, especially when you get into like hospital human resources and stuff like that. Boy. So
yeah, that's a whole other show.
Yeah, probably a couple. Yeah. That's a lot of credit to the people that are working on that, 'cause that sounds like a big time headache.
Yeah. It'll just be, you know, a journey. It's going to take time for sure.
Mm. Okay. All right. Well, speaking of a journey, you've been doing one of your own in this area, changing the title and the credential in your own program at Texas State.
So, right. I have. Thank you. So when I joined the Blueprint for Action Committee and we looked at those aims and things were going on, some of the leaders within that larger committee said, we would love for you, Dr. Rohde, as a chair of that program at Texas State to take this journey. And so, interestingly, it's something that I've been thinking about for probably 5 to 10 years. I became chair of our program in 2013, and we just hadn't done it for no other reason than the inertia to take it on. You know, it's sometimes a bureaucratic red tape kind of journey, but it was a perfect time. I said, well, since I'm on this committee, I can document it. I can provide data. I can create my journey, if you will, so that maybe other programs can follow suit. And so that's what I did. And so in the summer of 2022 is when I first started talking about this. And so we can kind of walk through that if you want to. It took about almost it's going to be about a 2-year process, because it's really already happened. Mm-hmm. But the final thing was getting our curriculum, all of our courses changed from CLS to MLS. And that was kind of the last part of it. And it's going to go into effect fall of 2024.
Okay.
But we will pretty much be complete starting this coming fall.
I would like to go through it a little bit, because I think it would just be good to talk about it. And maybe other people can, if they're trying to do the same thing, they can use some of the methods that you've used.
Let me first mention that we did a really nice, I can't remember the date. It's been 6 or 7 months ago. We did a really nice ASCLS, ASCP, NACLS, which is our national accrediting body, and some others, where we did a webinar, and we had about 3 or 4 of us do different presentations on this effort. And I did the one on my journey. So just a quick shout out, that webinar is available if anyone wants to go check it out, because there's some really good information that we may not get into here today. I guess I would start first with what I did, just kind of approaching this, because it was a big idea. And as you know, if you've ever been in a leadership position, you have to kind of get buy-in. So the first thing I did, let me just give you the kind of 4 big things I did, and then I'll walk through the process. So the first thing I did is I had to go collect data and information. And thankfully, I had great colleagues and great, you know, position papers and NACLS data and benchmarking, and all of that was available. So I did all that. That's one of the first thing I did.
Okay.
And then the second thing I did is I started meeting with our faculty, our alumni, our students, even my administration, to kind of start preparing them and putting together some of this information for them. Again, this part wasn't too bad, because a lot of us were ready for it, right? We had to educate our administration more than anything. And then the third big step was initiating and following Texas State institutional procedures to go through a program and degree name change. And I'll talk a little bit about that more. And then lastly, which is what we've been doing about the last 9 months, is implementing the approved changes, kind of getting those timelines set, moving forward with different things that I needed to prepare to move it forward.
Okay.
So that's kind of the big picture. And again, I can share with you if you'd like. I actually have a pretty cool infographic that I and some others kind of did to kind of help put this on almost a one infographic slide, because it's, you know, it's a process. It's a journey. And so let's try to walk through that somewhat if you want to. And I'll try not to get too far into the weeds. But so summer of 2022, I started meeting with faculty, staff, and students. So it was really just about awareness and discussing it. And as I said, they were all on board pretty quickly. And then at the end of that summer of 22, talked with our associate dean of academic affairs. This is within our own College of Health Professions, because that's where we have to start for name changes. And then that individual informed my dean. And in turn, that dean informed our upper administration, which for us is the provost level. And basically at that point, they came back to me through my dean and said, okay, we need a 1 to 2 page document, basically a proposal with details regarding basically why the change, how many other programs, you know, around the U.S. are doing this, and basically where are they located? So that was a task I was given late summer of 22. The other thing I did, so I started working on that, but while I was working on that, in the fall of 22, we have a system. Now this is unique to Texas State and maybe other state universities in Texas. So we can talk about this, that other universities may have to do it differently, but we have an inventory management. It's called a program inventory management system. It's a software system. And I had to go into that system and actually start a simple name change request. So it really wasn't that difficult, but that's where we start. So I did that. And then I put together my proposal. And so the proposal was what we just talked about. So briefly, I told them about a little bit about our history of our program, when we started, how we went from med tech to clinical lab science, and now we were going to MLS. Talked about really why, and I leaned on that blueprint for action from ASCP. It was a professional movement. It was really happening across the nation. It wasn't just me wanting to do it. And then I talked about those aims. And I specifically mentioned AIM 1, Recommendation 3B, which talked about this kind of idea of program name changes.
Okay.
And then gave them some literature, gave them some NACLS data that kind of showed them how many programs were out there. By the way, as of the end of 2022, we have about 245 MLS programs and about 239 MLT, which are associate degree programs. And I showed them that over a span from 2019 to 2022, that we increased from 61% to 67% across the nation for MLS. And MLT, which wasn't as hard because they've always been MLT, we're at about 92% there. Anyway, so I laid all that data out, and that was that. And so in the late fall of 22, the name change was approved by our College of Health Professions level college curriculum committee. So that's in my college. It was a simple process for me to kind of discuss our data, and they voted on it and it was approved.
Okay.
Then we jumped to spring 23. At that time, you moved to the university curriculum committee level to approve the name change and forwarded to the provost level. So this part's kind of important, because here is where the actual CLS to MLS program name change occurred, but we also made sure to ensure the degree, the transcript and the degree would have BS, Bachelor's of Science, and MLS on the degree. So in late spring of 23, our upper administration, including the provost, the president's cabinet, and our board of regents received all those requests. And in the summer of 23, they approved it. So yay. Our name change part was done at that point. We could start doing signage. We could start doing other things in our literature. What we still had to do now, Dennis, was again, kind of the next step, the next shoe to drop is curriculum. And so from August 23, really right up till now, we started the process of going through not only all the documentation and digital name changes and websites and social media accounts and forms, all that stuff. You know, a lot of people helping me. This was not Rodney by himself. A lot of good people helping me. And then the fall of 23, we entered in all of our course prefix name changes. which is a curriculum committee decision. When this kind of took place over the summer of 23, the fall of 23, and then recently in the spring of 24 in January, it made it all the way to the university level. And just to keep it simple, this is where every course we had to be changed from CLS to MLS and all the language as well. And I'm proud to say that as of about a month ago, everything has been approved. Everything has been approved. We are good to go. We're just now waiting to initiate our new curriculum names in the fall of 2024. So our students will be registering for MLS medical parasitology, for example. It'll no longer be CLS. And so all the verbiage in our courses and otherwise will be MLS. So starting the 24, every student that comes to my program will now be part of a medical laboratory science program. Their degrees will denote that, their transcripts and everything else. So we are pumped, proud, and excited to move forward.
That's amazing. That sounds like almost a 2-year process for this?
A 2-year process.
Yeah. That's got to be super rewarding for you and for your whole team involved that you did it. You pulled it off. You got it done.
Yeah. I really, took a moment to thank them. There's so many people, Dennis. I was just honored to lead it, but many, many, many workhorses across the spectrum, including, from the provost down that had to be educated, and all of them jumped on board. And so, throughout that process, I stayed obviously in close contact with the ASCP Blueprint for Workforce Committee. I documented this almost in a kind of a journey. That's what I've named it. And I did it in a Word document. So I wrote it up. And then over time, we kind of created a more concrete way to do that with an infographic and some other things. But I actually have the point by point steps I did, so that if I can help any other program, whether it's in Texas or otherwise, we have at least a toolbox, kind of a tool to provide to them to at least give them maybe a little less concern or a little less anxiety to start the process, because it does take time. And even though we talked about all that, it wasn't so much that it was massive workload over 2 years. It's like anything else in life. I'd be really busy for a week or two doing one thing, and then I might not do anything for 2 months.
Yeah, sure.
Really busy, for a committee request. So it just was kind of up and down. So it wasn't horrible. It's just when it came time, I had to kind of set aside other things and prioritize.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, you mentioned this tool. Is this available already for other programs to use, or how do they find it?
It is. It's definitely in that webinar.
Okay.
And I have it as basically a PowerPoint template slide, but I'd be willing to share that with you if you want to put that along with your other resources. It might be useful.
Yeah, definitely. With
a link to that webinar or something like that.
Okay. Yeah, I'll include that for sure. All right. Dr. Rohde, it's always an honor to have you on the podcast. I appreciate your time. I know you're always very busy, and I appreciate you making the time for me and for the podcast. Dr. Rodney Rohde, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dennis. And thank your team, and thank all of those out there who are doing this type of work. It's not just me. It is a huge team of great professionals. So thank you.
If you're looking for another episode of the People of Pathology podcast to check out after this one, here's a clip from my interview with Angela Tomei Robinson, where she talks about some of her advocacy efforts in her home state of New York.
And as I talked about with the coalition in New York State, it was such a collaboration of so many, and we gained bipartisan support in our state with our governor and our senators, our representatives. And it was everyone, scientists, technologists, technicians, they all believed that the profession had the right and deserved the right to be licensed to practice their profession. I recently was involved with an article for ASCLS, and I said professionalism is both a science and an art. It needs us individually as well as together for that one strong voice. And I've always believed, Dennis, that one individual can make a difference, but a group of individuals can make all the difference in the world. And despite the challenges today and the severe challenges, I still believe this, because again, it's better to do something than to do nothing.
You can hear more from Angela Tomei Robinson in episode 96. Great big thanks to Dr. Rodney Rohde. It's an honor to have him back on the podcast. Improving visibility
of medical laboratory careers is crucial in addressing the workforce shortages and recruitment challenges faced by the healthcare industry. One initiative that is making significant strides in this area is ASCP's Blueprint for Action, which aims to increase the visibility of clinical laboratory occupations, improve workforce retention, and recruitment of all laboratory professionals. In the article that Dr. Rohde published with Angela Tomei Robinson, they highlighted four areas for advocacy efforts: media attention, public awareness, industry respect, and legislative support. One solution that touches on several of these areas is standardization of a title and credential. Years ago, this position was called medical technologist. In some situations, it became clinical laboratory scientist. There were even a few other titles, depending on where you worked. In order to consolidate efforts to promote the field, it became clear that a single title that everyone agreed on was needed, and the consensus was medical laboratory scientist. Now, if you're going to create a title change yourself, there are a few key steps in the journey of title standardization. We can see these steps through the effort of Dr. Rohde and his team at Texas State University. Data collection is the first step. Why is it necessary to change the title? Have other programs done this successfully? Developing support for a title change is next. This is where public awareness comes in. It's also about getting support from professional organizations. Third is to initiate and follow institutional procedures. This could be very different from Dr. Rohde's experience. The main point is to check all of the boxes, dot those I's and cross those T's, so you don't get sidetracked by an administrative mistake. Finally, you implement the approved change. Congratulations, you've been approved. Now, it's time for the hard part. Here's where you coordinate changing the website, maybe the logo, all the class titles, advertising, brochures, and some things you probably never even thought of. Yay me! Advocating for lab professions is an ongoing process. So I'll borrow a phrase from Angela and Dr. Rohde's article. Do not be part of the precipitate. Become part of the solutions. You can go to the show notes to find resources that Dr. Rohde gave me about these topics. The article is there, the link to the webinar, even the infographic. It's all there in the show notes. Don't forget, you can follow this show on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at People of Path, or just connect with me on LinkedIn. Thank you for continuing to share the show with others. Together, let's inspire the next generation of pathologists and laboratory professionals. This show is a member of Health Podcast Network, which connects listeners with conversations and stories about health, care, and well-being. You can find a link in the show notes to Health Podcast Network, and while you're there, check out some of their other interesting podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Dennis Strank, and I'll talk to you next time on the People of Pathology podcast.